Hi, y'all. My name is Palmer Grace. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I came into this fellowship March 5th of 1990, and I am so grateful for that time. As I might add, is my family and my friends. A lot of people were praying for me, and you know, it's funny because they're not praying for me at all. They're praying to get me out of the way so God's message can come through. And I hope that that can happen, because I can screw it up. I want to thank some people. Everybody who has put this conference together, Scott, the whole crew, I mean, you have just done an incredible job on this conference. This is just incredible. I was talking to my sponsor and she said this is one of her favorite conferences in the country. And I can see why. You guys have really, really done an incredible job. I want to thank Shelley and, oh, she disappeared, and Teresa. For inviting me to come. It is really a privilege to be here. I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, I really appreciate your concern, compassion, and love for the family that you will allow us to share the podium. That's not a small thing. And I think that we forget sometimes in Al-Anon that what a debt that we owe to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and their love for the family. I mean, all through the big book, it is scattered where, you know, if the prospect doesn't want the message, stay for the family because they need it too. I really do believe that alcoholism is a family illness and that a family disease, and that all of the family suffer from that. And I think sometimes in Al-Anon we forget that it is the disease of alcoholism from which we suffer. It is not the hand of the alcoholic. And I hear over and over again people talking about, well, that alcoholic, and it's not the alcoholic, it's the disease of alcoholism. And I came already primed and ready and full of the disease before I ever met her. So the speakers, you know, you have just done an amazing job. Thank you so much for your message. I love being at a conference because this is where we keep newcomers, and it's where we keep people who are into action doing the deal. And so thank you for being here. See if I forgot anybody here. I'm confused. Joe. Now, I saw the program with Josie from San Diego and Josie from Palm Coast, Florida, and I thought, I know Joe's confused. I mean, I've heard him before, but I thought he knew where he was from, and so finally I've decided that this is, you know, Florida Joe and California Joe so that I can straighten it out in my mind. But you guys have done a good job, and Kent and Maria is one of my favorite, and Sheldon. All of you have just done an incredible job, and I'm looking forward to the rest, too. So how did I get here? You know, I don't know. I grew up in a family that absolutely loved me. And I wasn't supposed to be born because of a serious radiation accident in my father, and be one else ever supposed to be able to bear children, but in about 5-6 years... here I came. You know, my wife says that I glow in the dark, but, you know, my two sisters just loved me. My parents loved me. And yet, that's not the message I heard. I felt less than. I mean, you know, my parents were geniuses. I mean, literally brilliant people. They were both physicists on the Manhattan Project. And so when I say that they were brilliant, that's not an understatement. They really were. My sister was brilliant. You know, she did stuff like she graduated from college at 14 or 15 or from high school and went to college and got out in 3 years and went and got her PhD. And then she went and got one job, and she just retired from that one job. It's kind of like Keith Lewis's brother, Dumb Danny. You know, it's like, I don't know, how do you do that? How do you do that? And of course, I followed her in school, and all the teachers would say, why can't you be like her? Meaning my sister. Well, I couldn't. You know, I just can't live up to that image. And so I'm the class screw up. Now, I'm filled with old ideas. I mean, you know, my perception is that I'm unloved. My perception is that my classmates just kind of tolerated my existence. They didn't want me around. And all of these ideas that I had about my childhood, I understand today I suffer from a disease of perception. I was at a class reunion about 10 years ago, maybe 15, and this guy came up and said, "Well, of course I remember you, Palmer. You were always one of the popular kids in class." And, you know, I'm kind of, what? You know, who are you talking about? And my perception doesn't match reality. I sometimes hear alcoholics say, you know, well, if you want to really know what happens, talk to, you know, my wife, my husband, whatever, because the Al-Anon, remember, that's not my experience. My experience is that I'm living in my head and my perceiver is wrong. Often it is wrong. So anyway, I grew up, I'm full of fear. I just don't know how to do life. I'm not comfortable in my own skin. I'm just out of sorts. You know, it's as if the week I was to be born, I was with a bunch of other people that were going to be born that week, and I had run to the bathroom, and I came back, and God says, "And that's everything you need to know while you're on earth." You know, I missed the instruction set. I just didn't know how to be around you. And so even if I were going out to dinner with one other person, I'm sure that if I skipped it, I wouldn't be missed. In fact, there would be some relief. You know, that's how I grew up. I was full of fear. I was steeped in fear. So, you know, with all that going on, you'd think that, at least a lot of you in this room, would think that if I took a drink, it would at least irrigate that feeling and my shoulders could come off my ears and I could... You know, well, that happened at 13. You know, I went and really tied one on, and I really got drunk, and I had to go. I mean, I just, you know, for me, the magic didn't happen. I got up the next morning. I was hungover. I had to go to church hungover, and it was like, oh, no, I'm not ever going to do that again. Now, my friends in AA say that, Palmer, you can work through that and get to the good stuff. You gotta push on, Palmer. But I'm a quitter. You know, what can I say? I'm a quitter. And I abused alcohol a lot, you know. I mean, I had this, it started out 10-year-old bottle of scotch, and then it was 15, and then it was 18 years. And I actually put the cork back in. That's alcohol abuse, I hear. So, yeah, Scott's over here. Yeah. So, you know, growing up in that home with those kind of feelings and you know, there just wasn't a solution. And so I figured that there's got to be somewhere where I can get some relief. And so when I graduated from high school, I went up to Portland, Oregon. And you know, that was about as far away as I could go. And I went to school there. And I fell in with a crowd. You know, just wonderful crowd. It was the 70s, you know. I had hair down my back and beard down on my belly. And we did drink. And it was the 70s. We did inhale. Do some of those cousins that something that Sheldon was talking about or somebody was talking about. Yeah. You know, I did that a lot, but you know, I don't know. I still arrived, and I'm still uncomfortable in my own skin. And so I did college for about 2 years, and that's just all I could take. You know, there was a world going on there. It was calling to me. And of course, she moved down to Haight-Ashbury. I'm not really don't remember who she was, but I know that she went to Haight-Ashbury. So I went down and lived on Haight-Ashbury. And you know, I was, I got there. And you know, this was, if you've seen movies, I mean, you know, a lot of you are young, some of you may remember, but you know, it was the love generation. We loved you. And so I was hanging out with all these people, having a good time. And yet I was alone and lonesome, apart from, there's something broken about me. And you know, it's everywhere I go, there I am. But I always think that somewhere just down the road, maybe this will fix me. And if I can just get there, I'll be okay. Well, Haight-Ashbury wasn't it. So I left there and went to a commune in New Mexico and moved in. And, you know, again, it was a great time. We had a lot of fun with those cousins. And I, but I was still alone and lonesome. I remember one night we were talking about love, because that's what a bunch of hippies did. You know, we love you. And I said, in a moment of honesty or weakness, I'm not sure, but I just said, you know, I don't feel it. I don't get it. And so they picked me up. They were rocking me back and forth horizontally so that I would feel loved. And again, I was lonesome, apart from, separate. I just am a broken child. And I don't know where that came from. I'm glad it did, but I don't know where it came from. It was just, I just had this wall in front of me, this cellophane wall that I could not reach out and you couldn't reach in. And I don't know. You know, just, I was visiting my mom at the time. She was dying of cancer down in the hospital in Albuquerque. And so I'd either hitchhike down or hop a freight down and go visit her and stay with her. And I just started getting uncomfortable, which is what I do. I think the best descriptor I've ever heard is Clancy, who talks about somebody sneaks in the middle of the night and sticks a spring in his gut, and every night they'll come crank it up another notch and another notch and another notch. And it came to a point where I just had to blow. I could not stay because I was so uncomfortable at that place, at that time, doing what I was doing. I had to leave. So I went down to the hospital and I told Mom, "Mom, I got to leave. I'm out of here. You know, goodbye. I love you." And you know, I left her dying of cancer in the hospital. But, you know, I wasn't there. I was selfish and self-centered. That was the root of my problem, and I did not understand that. I just thought I was. I didn't know what to think. I just had to get out. So I went to Virginia Beach, and I was staying on the beach there, doing what a bunch of hippies do on the beach. And the state police came and found me after about 3 weeks, and they said, "Call home." And I called home, and they were just coming in from Mom's funeral. You know, I wasn't there. I wasn't a son, I wasn't a brother, I wasn't a nephew, I wasn't a part of the family doing what a family does at that time because of my selfish, self-centered seeking. And I don't know what to do with that. I mean, how do you deal with that? Because it was such an incredible impact of guilt that I just stuffed it down. I didn't know what to do with it. And I didn't find out what to do with it for many years. I just carried that around, not admitting it, trying to stuff it. So I went back to Los Alamos and I was taking care of the home and doing all that. You know, I tell my story this way deliberately because, you know, I've not mentioned alcoholism in my family. We can tell already that I'm crazy as a loon, and yet there's no alcoholism. I have to remember for me that I am my own qualifier for Al-Anon. I marry alcoholic women because I qualify for Al-Anon. I don't qualify for Al-Anon because I marry alcoholic women. I am my problem. And if that's the case, then there's a solution. If she's my problem, it's helpless, hopeless, it will never get any better because I can't fix her. You can't fix her. All I can do is work on me and allow God in to work on me. And so it's good that I know that. I was street musician and a potter, and I was playing music in this coffee house. Now, for you youngins here, this is not Starbucks. It was an old dark place, and it's not that much different. We'd sit around, talk about grandiose ideas, and the big difference was we didn't have Wi-Fi. Of course, we didn't have computers either, but, and one night she came in. She walked in. And I tell you what, she got my attention. And so I played two more songs and put my guitar down and went over and started talking to her, and we began a courtship. 5 minutes later, we moved in together. My sponsor laughs and she says that, "Well, we know everything we need to know in 5 minutes. Why wait?" So, and I didn't. I'm good to go here. So, I don't know who took whom hostage, but it was bizarre. I'd been on this mesa that afternoon. I'm just lost and I don't understand what's going on. And I kind of said this halfway prayer plea. I don't know what it was. You know, show me what this is all. Give me the wisdom to understand what I'm here for. And of course, that night God delivered me an alcoholic and in his great sense of humor. Boy, I tell you what, did I get an education, and as did she. So we began the dance. Now, you know, she was a geographical kind of person, too, because there must be something out there that's going to fix us. So we moved up to Oregon, and then I had a mansion. We cut the lodge poles and set my teepee up on the side of Mount Hood. And lived there. And you know, it was an amazing time. What I have to know and remember and share is that when I met her, I could feel that immediate sense of ease and comfort that came from being with her. You know, I choose those words deliberately because it comes out of the doctor's opinion, as you know, that an alcoholic gets a sense of ease and comfort at once from taking a few drinks. That didn't happen for me, but when I met her, immediately I felt at ease. I felt comfortable in my own skin. My music was better. I was funnier, wittier. My fingers worked better on the keyboard and strumming and picking. And everything was just right. And when we moved up to Oregon, it was an amazing time because for the first time in my life, I was comfortable in my own skin living with her. And it was great. It lasted maybe 3 weeks. and then, of course, that spring in my gut started twisting, and it was not working for me. So we took the teepee down and moved over to Eastern Oregon and began the dance. And I had my first brush with an alcoholic. My sister-in-law came up, and you know, she drank with an intensity that I had never observed. She drank with a thirst that I had never seen. And she couldn't keep her kids. She left them with us. And went downtown Redmond, Oregon, got a job as a barmaid, which is a great gig for an alcoholic woman because she got all she needed and all she wanted and it didn't run out. And I watched that and I'm bewildered because for an Al-Anon, that drinking with that intensity is just confusing and bewildering and I didn't understand. And one Sunday the kids were with her and they were running out and up and down the street screaming, and my sister-in-law was bleeding out of a slit wrist. And nobody told me that's alcoholism. I didn't understand that she was dying of alcoholism. We got her patched up, and I took her to a detox. You know, there wasn't treatment back then. It was just a jitter joint. You know, she shook it out, and I had my first introduction to you. You know, they had all these bizarre half sentences on the wall, you know, easy does it. And I'm saying, easy does what? Or live and let live. Yeah, that's helpful. Think. Well, yeah, okay. But I saw that they could do something with Bobby Joe that I certainly could not do. I didn't understand the power that was in that room. But I saw it, and she came out with a big book. This was back when we had the second edition. And I fell in love with that book. I just absolutely loved and resonated with what was in the big book. And I'd read it with Bobby Joe, and I didn't know that she didn't stay sober. She started drinking again, went back out. I didn't know that. I just knew that Alcoholics Anonymous had fixed her. And I thanked you for that. But again, Oregon stopped working. That gut started getting stronger and, you know, just tighter and tighter. And again, we had to leave. And I moved down to Oklahoma. And I was I got this little subsistence farm in the eastern part of Oklahoma. I picked up the farm and my accent. So we were out there. And I was working with my father-in-law. You know, he was an incredible guy. He worked with cutting horses. A strong man. And he had an incredible gift with horses. And I worked with him. It was a neat place to live, a neat things to do. One time he just disappeared. And I didn't know where he went. About 2 months later, I found him down in Poto, Oklahoma at a flop house. And, you know, he was just this gray, pasty shell of a man that he had once been. He said, take me to detox. And so I put them in the car and I was in a truck and I was taking them over to McAllister, Oklahoma. There was a jitter joint over there. And so I was taking him in and he said, Palmer, buy me a beer. I'm going, why am I going to buy you a beer? I'm taking you to detox. And he made me understand that he was feeling bugs crawling on him. There was stuff in the car that I certainly couldn't see, but he was seeing. He was experiencing DTs and I did not know what they were. But I bought him a beer and took him into detox. You know, for the family, it is bewildering to see this event going on. And so, you know, I put him in. And again, he came out. I saw these half sentences on the wall and introduction to you again. And I loved what I saw. You know, I just loved what I've always resonated with Alcoholics Anonymous and loved what you do. My wife was drinking and drugging. Now, I got to tell you, I didn't have a problem with that. I was not a teetotal Al-Anon. I'd jump right in with her. In fact, we had this one watering hole where we went. It was a Turkey Creek Saloon that was so far back up in the mountains of Oklahoma, it didn't even have electricity. They ran it on Honda generators. And you could buy moonshine, Bud Light, Budweiser, hard stuff, whatever you wanted. And I just loved the moonshine that was up there. And I'd play music and drink and play music, and I had a good time. And I've looked at, I've done inventories, you know, am I alcoholic? And I'm not. I mean, you know, nothing happens to me like it happens to the alcoholic. When I start drinking, I don't find that it's hard to stop. I know this is bizarre for some of you, but I mean, and when I'm stopped, I don't have this mental obsession that I should have one. If I do decide to have one, I can have one. You know, how bizarre is that? But I liked it. Now, she, on the other hand, she seemed to do things a little differently. And she started breaking out in really weird things and doing weird things and stuff. And I started having this need to watch her. I mean, if you're an Al-Anon and you've been around an alcoholic acting alcoholically, they need watching. So I'd go up here more to watch her than I would to experience Turkey Creek. And I'd start putting myself in a position where I would be harmed. I mean, one time she signed up. We had this guy, David Allen Coe, come up. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's kind of an outlaw musician, and he attracts a rough crowd. And so she was going to be a barmaid for this concert, and I decided I'm going to be security. I signed up for security. But I'm a wimp. I mean, what am I going to do? Go up to somebody, some big guy, and say, gee, sir, would you please put your gun away? But she needed watching, and I would put myself in a position where I could be harmed in order to make sure that she was not doing whatever it was that she's doing. And I became real curious, and I'm kind of like Maria, I'm a detective. I'd walk in the house and I'd look at all the ashtrays and where the ashtrays were, and I could just intuitively know what it was that was happening in my home that day. And of course, I have no clue whether or not I'm right, but I sure think I'm right. I know I'm right, you know, because I know, you know, knowing best is one of my outstanding defects of character. And things got worse. And we have this Al-Anon pamphlet that is a reprint of the chapter to wives. And I hated that the first time I read it because it talks about, well, the reason I hated it, I thought, was, you know, it's antiquated, it's sexist, doesn't he know that there are men who live with alcoholism? And in fact, that's not why I hated it. When I finally got in the program, I realized I hated it because it was as if Bill was looking in my bedroom and living room window when he wrote that, because he describes my home, the despairing children, the despairing wives, in this case husband, and the affairs and the retaliatory affairs, and the family disease of alcoholism was alive and well in my home, and he described it. And I couldn't face it at that time. I would start doing bizarre things to you know, drive by sightings to see what bar she was at, or drive by his house to see if she was there. And I never felt good when I found out what it was she was doing. I remember one time she was going to go up to a party at the lake. I couldn't go because I was doing something at the farm. I don't remember what it was, but she took the truck and went up to the lake. Now, about dark, I had no defense against the first think. I had to know what she was doing and with whom she was doing it. And, of course, I have no car, so what do? Well, I jump on my tractor. And I'm driving up over this mountain and down these hairpin turns in the night with no lights and no moon to go do this sneaky drive-by sighting. You know, it's just nuts. And now, my tractor didn't have a muffler, and so had they have been there, they could have heard me for a half a mile coming up, and I thought I was being sneaky. You know, we talk about insanity. It's just, it was nuts. But I got up to the lake, and there was nobody there. Now, they could have been out hiding in the weeds laughing at me, and or never could have been there. I don't know what happened. And part of my delusion is that when I saw, oh, they're not here, it didn't even occur to me, well, where are they? I just turned around and left. And I drove back up over the mountain, down the hairpin turns, back to the farm, and I was okay. But I was crazy. You know, I did other drive-by sightings. You know, I parked myself by a motel one night at 20 degrees, watching the back of the motel to make sure she didn't go out. Of course, she could have gone out the front door, and I never knew it. You know, we are nuts. And we went to marriage counseling, and they call it couples therapy today, I guess. But we went, she kept saying, you know, she's drinking because I do whatever I do or I don't do something. And it was always my fault that she did what she did. And I bought into that. The counselor bought into that. He believed it too. He said, yeah, you need to stop doing these things. And by the way, you might want to take some medication for that. But, you know, I have this need to look good to the neighbors. I have to maintain this facade at all cost of we're very good, thank you very much. We're fine, thank you very much. And so, I'm sure that marriage counselors can do great things if they have the raw data to work with. But of course, I didn't tell him there's alcohol and drugs in the home, because what would he think? So, you know, all he had was what she said. And I believed it. I believed that she drank because of what I did or didn't do. And so I started trying to do what I was supposed to do or not do what I was supposed to do. And I just got sicker and sicker. And a little increment at a time, I got crazier. And I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I just, you know, if she said do A, I'd do A. And then she'd go get drunk because I was supposed to be doing B. But you said to do A. Well, no, but you're supposed to do B. You know, I mean, it's just I'm always out of balance because I can't get it right. You know, I just got nuts. And one time my mother-in-law came down and she said, Palmer, is she drinking a lot? And I said, no, Mom, she's fine. Is she doing drugs? No, Mom, she's fine. We're fine. Thank you very much. Because, again, I've got to maintain that facade. In order to maintain that facade, I had to cut a lot of people out. We didn't have many friends left. Because if you let friends in your house, they know what's going on in your home. And I couldn't allow that. We had one couple who were still friends, and they invited us to come to a movie on Friday night. And so the night arrived, we were going to go. And she said, I don't want to go. You stay. Or you go. I'm going to stay. I don't feel good. And I said, well, I'll stay. She said, no, you go. So I went. I don't remember the movie. It was one of those Freddy or Friday the 13th or some bizarre movie where, you know, but I didn't really watch it because I was thinking about what she's doing. You know, is she okay? You know, and I got home and there was a rifle sticking out the door. And she said, get the hell out and don't you ever come back. Now, I did. I jumped in my truck and left, but it's confusing. I mean, I just went and watched a movie and you told me to go. Why? I don't understand. Well, she went and got a lawyer and was going to sue me. sue me for divorce. I just went and watched a movie. You know, what am I going to do? And so 3 weeks later, we were supposed to meet with her attorney, or I was. So I walked into her attorney's office, and she was there. And she said, "Palmer, come here, man. I want to talk to you." She said, "I don't know what was wrong with me that night. I love you. I need you. Please come home." Now, for the Al-Anon, that "I need you" is kind of like a mainline shot for a junkie. You know, boom, boom. I fired my lawyer on the spot and went home. You know, of course I would. She needs me. You know, that's the insanity of my disease. Was it Joe that was talking about, you know, the insanity of "I'm just going to have one and I changed my mind," maybe two, you know, at most three. And then it's off. It's on, you know, you're off. And I'm kind of the same way, you know. My insanity says, "Oh, she needs me. I can come home now. All will be well." And so I go home. It doesn't get better, but, you know, when alcoholism really gets going, it's a downhill slide. I don't care what you put in the way of it. It is a downhill slide, and it got worse. And I laugh because, you know, of course, my need to look good to the neighbors, I had to take the gun back to my other friend who was a neighbor and give it back to him because it was his. And of course, you know, how do you give a gun back to a guy, the gun that had just run you off to Arkansas, And without letting on what's going on in the home? I said, "Well, Jack, you know, I think she suffers from PMS." You know, I can admit that, but alcoholism, oh no, we can't do that. I had this newcomer plan. I decided that, you know, what I really needed to do was get a job where I could be at home. Now, I know that some of you are teachers, so please don't listen to this, but I decided that, you know, I could teach high school, and you just go to work at 10 and get off at 2, and you get your summers off, and you get your nights off, you know. I'm a teacher today. I know how insane that was, but... I decided I was going to go back to the university and get my teaching certificate. Now, I had dropped out of college. All I had was a high school diploma, and of course, I was a stupid one in the family. I don't know why I thought that this would work, but I did. So I started this commute from the farm up to Norman, Oklahoma, and I entered the University of Oklahoma, and I started working on a bachelor's degree in science education. But home was crazy. You know, it was just crazy. And I would start doing this thing. I'd drive home on Thursday or Friday night based on my class schedule. And I would go into these Al-Anon brownouts. I was so obsessed with her and what she was doing, what she wasn't doing, who she was doing it with, that I would literally not be aware of the drive. I would drive for an hour, hour and a half, and end up in this town. I have no clue how I got there. I mean, I just don't know, because I'm up here in my obsession of the mind thinking about her. And I'd walk in and I'd say, "What's the fight going to be about today?" And of course, the fight was on. But who picked it? You know, every time when I started doing inventories, every time I looked at our fights, it was my mouth flapping. And if I had kept my mouth closed, a lot of those would never have happened. You know, I love the inventory because we saw that I was wrong in my building of the relationship. I kept going back on the weekends and back up to school, and my mother-in-law came down again, and she said, "Palmer, is she drinking?" And I said, "No, Mom, she's not drinking." And she said, "Palmer, you're acting weird." You know, it says in our ODAD, some of our Al-Anon literature, that it's often easier to spot an alcoholic home by the actions of the children and the spouse, much more easily than the actions of the alcoholic. And she knew that it was going on in my home because of my actions and reactions. And she said, "Palmer, I want to tell you a story." There was a lady that lived in a bad drunk and with a bad drunk, and she tried everything she could to straighten that relationship out, to get him to moderate or drink sensibly, and never with success. And she went into him one day and said, "You know, hon, is there anything that I can do to help you to stop drinking?" And he said, "Yeah, you know, I believe that if you'd go out and dig a dozen worms and bring them in and fry them, I could eat those worms and stop drinking." We'll go to anything to do that. So she went out and dug a fat choice worms, a dozen of them, brought them in, breaded them, fried them, put them out on a platter beautifully, brought them to him. And he said, "You eat half." Well, we'll go to any length. So she cut them in half and ate her half. And he went and got a bottle of bourbon and began to get drunk. And she's going, "Why? Why?" I mean, "I dug the worms. I ate the worms." And he said, "Yeah, you ate the wrong half." You know, when she told me that story, that was my first step moment. I realized that everything that I had attempted had gone awry, that I could not make that difference in her. And she said, "Palmer, you've got to go to Al-Anon." And I didn't do it yet because there's got to be, maybe I can fix this still. But I knew from that story that, yeah, I'm powerless over alcohol. Every time I get in the ring with alcoholism, I lose. And so I went back up, and it was maybe a week or two later that one Thursday night we were having this brutal, wicked fight over the telephone, and I just gave up. I didn't know what to do. You know, there was no friendly direction, and I just didn't know what to do. So I looked in the phone book for Al-Anon, and I couldn't find it, but I found AA. It's easier to spell. And I called you. And I am so grateful for groups like that where AA, Al-Anon, Alateen, the whole family meets in one place. And because the AA guy that I got on the phone was so compassionate, and he loved the family, and he had read in the big book where the family will come with need as well. And he handed the phone to a lady in Al-Anon. And Doris listened to me, blah, you know, I was whining and crying, and "I don't know what's going on." And she said, "Palmer, I think we can help you. Please come in." And that was Thursday night. They met Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday. Sunday, I was traveling back up from the farm. So Monday, March 5th of 1990, I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting. And all I can tell you is that I was home. I absolutely loved being in Al-Anon. For that hour, I was safe. For that hour, I was surrounded by love. Now, I got to tell you, these old women, they were old women. I mean, they were probably 15 years younger than I am today. And there were no men in Al-Anon anywhere. I have a disease of perception. There were, but I didn't know that. There weren't any in any of the meetings I went to. But they met me at the door and gave me a hug and hugged me when I left, saying, "You keep coming back. We need you." Of course, you know, if you need me, I probably can fit it in my schedule. Those old women were so courageous. And because, you know, I didn't look like what I do now. I was a lot like Charlie Manson, if you've ever seen pictures of him. You know, I was dirty. I didn't smell very good. Because, you know, when you're obsessed with her, bathing is optional. And, you know, long, dirty, gritty hair and beard and no light in my eyes. There was nobody home. And they just hugged me. And they've told me since that, you know, I scared them. They were frightened, and yet they knew that I suffered from this family disease, and they just met me and loved me. Thank God for those women. They were saying really bizarre, weird things. Because, you know, I didn't know, "God, do I stay? Do I go? What do I do? You know, should I divorce her? What?" And we were talking about the Serenity Prayer one night, you know, "Grant me the wisdom to know the difference." And I asked him afterwards. I said, "I don't get it. What part of her can I change and what part can't I change?" And they kind of smiled and said, Palmer, why don't you go get the ODAT and tonight read all the readings in, you know, look it up in the back. And they showed me where the index was in the ODAT and said, why don't you read all of these readings on changing what I can? And so I went back and I read them. I came back the next night and I said, I don't get it. I still don't see what part of her can I change and what can't I change. And they just smiled and said, read those readings again. Let's see if you can see it. Finally, you know, it dawned on me. I'm a slow learner. I came back and said, oh, I see. I can only change me. That's right. So let's get on that. You know, the first meeting I went to, they said the three C's. They said, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it. And I didn't understand that because I had fully accepted to my innermost self that I caused her to drink. And they said, no, Palmer, if she's an alcoholic, she drinks because she's an alcoholic. You're not that powerful, nor you cannot cause it, nor can you stop it. You can't do that. They said, but we have a solution for you, and you don't have to live the way you're living anymore. And I'm so grateful they told me that because I was absolutely a wreck. You know, I had no hope. I had no friendly direction. I didn't know what to do. And so I kept asking them, what do I do? Do I stay? Do I go? Do I get a divorce? What do I do? And they said, well, Palmer, you don't know. And as long as you don't know, you don't know. But when you know, you'll know. What? You know, I guess I learned that in sponsor school, but I didn't know. And so they said, it's okay to make a decision not to make a decision today. And I said, okay. So I started doing the deal. Every time the room opened, I went to a meeting. And about 2 months later, I was at home for the weekend, and I was laying on a cot. And she came in with a butcher knife right over me. She said, Palmer, you've got to go to sleep sometime. When you do, you're a dead man. And, you know, I just looked at her and I just rolled over and went to sleep. I had achieved and gotten to this point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that strikes all of us. And I just rolled over and went to sleep. I woke up in the morning and I knew that night I had attempted suicide from my despair. And I got up and I uttered that prayer that so many of us utter, God help me. And he did. I immediately knew that I was done. I was done. I could no longer live in this relationship, and so I left. I left my dog, I left the farm, I left my son, I left my wife. All I had was my truck, my guitar, an extra pair of jeans, and an extra shirt. And I just hit the road. And I didn't know where I was going. I just didn't know. I lived in my truck for a short time and ended up on a couch with some people in Norman, Oklahoma that had just come out of a halfway house. Of course, who am I going to find, you know? But and we began this magical journey. You know, we'd get up in the morning. We'd read literature from the Al-Anon literature, from the AA literature. We'd have a meeting. We'd go about our business, come back in the evening and have a meeting. And then we'd go to a meeting. You know, I would go to every Al-Anon meeting I could find. I'd go to every open AA meeting. I'd go to book studies. I just dove in the program. I even went to closed AA meetings that I didn't know were closed. And when I introduced myself as Palmer, I'm an Al-Anon, they'd say, this is a closed meeting. And I said, I'm so sorry, I'll leave. And they said, no, wait a minute. And they took a group conscience and allowed me to stay. And I don't know how to say thank you to you for that. Because they could tell that I was in desperate shape and needed a meeting. And so they allowed me to sit with them. You know, thank you so much for that. Everybody kept saying something about get a sponsor. And I didn't know what that was. But one night this guy came through Al-Anon. There were men in Al-Anon. Go figure. And I asked him to sponsor me. And he listened to me whine and moan about being homeless for a week or two. I don't know. That wasn't 2 weeks probably. And he said, Palmer, I've got an assignment for you. I want you to go home, get a piece of paper and a pen, and I want you to write one thing for which you're grateful. And I went home and I thought, well, actually, I thought at the time, I said, have you not been listening to me? I mean, what's the matter with you? Of course, I didn't say that. I said, okay. So I went home and I thought and I thought and I tried to think of something I could be grateful for. and I couldn't come up with anything. I finally wrote, I'm grateful I only have to write one damn thing on my gratitude list. And that's what I wrote. And I took it back to my sponsor, and I thought, well, this will fix that. He'll see the futility of this stupid exercise. And I handed it to him, and he said, that's great. Now I want you to write two things. And then it was five things. And then it was 10 things. And one of the things that I noticed in about a week or two weeks is that I was feeling grateful. Absolutely nothing in my life had changed except my perception and my attitude. And it came about from doing some stupid exercise that my sponsor had come up with. So all I have to do is take direction and do what my sponsor says and get into action. And I'm so grateful for that lesson. I started doing other stuff. I mean, he took me into the steps immediately. And of course, you know, for me, the first step, it was no great deal for me because I knew that every time I got in the ring with alcoholism, I lose every time. And I know that I had managed my way out of a home, out of a farm, into a state of homelessness. That was not a reach. I'd already done the first step. I know that I'm absolutely powerless and my life is unmanageable. And we got to the second step, and I was a little bit concerned with that. I mean, you know, there's a left-handed admission that we're insane if we're going to be restored to sanity, and I'm not insane, thank you very much. And he reminded me, Palmer, what was that tractor deal? I was like, oh, yeah. And in a moment of weakness, I had told him about a bunch of other things that I had done that are just absolute insanity. And in fact, going back to her, you know, a normal person would think twice, I think, about going back to somebody who 2 weeks previously had held a gun to their head. But, you know, it didn't occur to me. It was like, oh, yeah, she needs me. You know, this level of insanity was really apparent. So I really did come to believe that maybe, just maybe, what you had would work for me. I mean, you guys are laughing and hugging and having a great time, and I wanted what you had, and maybe it would work. And that belief started growing in me, and that hope in my gut of, oh, yeah, maybe. And then, of course, we got to the third step, and I'm kind of like Sheldon. I knew you were talking about God. You know, it's like you can disguise it as HP and higher power, but I know you're talking about God, and I don't do God. I just don't do God. And so I said, no, I'm not going there. And he took me into the chapter of the agnostic. And it says in there, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. And I'm sitting here doing this debate, gosh, do I go back to the farm or do I do this step? And I didn't want to do the step, but yet I didn't want to go back, and I have a dilemma. I don't know which way to go. I don't know where to turn. And he took me a little bit further, and it says, do you believe, or are you willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? And I had to say, I don't believe. I'm a lot like Sheldon. But he said, are you willing? And I look around at what you have, and I want what you have. And if what you did to get what you have is to say this third step prayer, I guess I'm willing. And so we knelt down, said the third step prayer, and I was off and running. Now, nothing immediately happened that I'm aware of, except, well, there was. He says that, you know, at once followed by rigorous action meant that right now you do the fourth step. And he believed that, so I started on an inventory. And I loved the first part. You know, I can list this list of all the people that I resent, and people, places, things, institutions, ideas that I resent, and I did that, and a little bit about them, you know, like 18 words about them. I couldn't write a volume about each one. And that was okay. I could even look at how it affected me. But then he made me turn the page, and it says, referring to our list again, we looked at where we were at fault. And so I started that fourth column, and the most amazing thing happened for me. I realized, and this is really in the fifth step too, I realized that all of these hundreds of resentments that I felt I really only had about four resentments hundreds of times, because it all came back to the same defect of character in me. And that's the great news, because if that happens, then we can take it on. We have a solution for those defects of character. And he took them into the sixth and seventh step with me. Now, when I said the seventh step prayer, the first thing that came to my mind was rage. You know, I didn't get just angry. I went enraged, just from irritation to rage, just like that. And I asked God to remove that from me. And the neat thing was that all of a sudden, I had a 20-second fuse inserted between mild resentment and rage. And each time I had that 20 seconds where I could look at, do I really want to go to rage? And somehow I could choose to not get enraged. I don't understand it. I just know that it happened. And because when I went, I never liked the emotional hangover that I felt by getting enraged. And so I started choosing, and I had this ability to let God remove it each time. I don't remember the last time I got enraged. I mean, I can get angry, but a little ticked off, but it's gone very quickly. I don't get enraged. That was just removed. Now, some of the defects of character, that's not true, because I don't get to choose which ones that he removes. All I get to do is to ask each time, and I did. One of the neat things that happened to me in the sixth and seventh step as I was doing them is I was in this room of about 10 people, and I noticed something's wrong. And I stepped off to the side for a little moment of reflection to see what was wrong. And all of a sudden I understood that what was wrong was I was feeling absolutely comfortable conversing with about 10, 12 people in this room. I was comfortable in my own skin, and I don't know when it happened. I never observed it happening. All of a sudden, I just became aware of being comfortable. I was off doing stupid stuff like gratitude lists and inventories and shut up and get in the car meetings and all this stuff, and somehow God had gotten into me and removed that defect where I was all of a sudden comfortable loving and being loved. Amazing stuff. My sponsor left, and so I was in need of another one. I sponsored myself for a short time, which is really a dumb idea. In case you've tried it, it's just not a very good idea. I mean, if I'd get a resentment, my sponsor would say, well, you should. You earned it. Yeah. So I got another sponsor. The other thing I started doing was I began this courtship of another woman, and you know, we really did do a date, and you know, she was an earth person. She didn't need a program, but she didn't mind me being part of Al-Anon. She just you know, she was accepting, and she was an earth girl. After a year, we decided to get married, and we did. And I noticed on the honeymoon, God, she drinks a lot, and. I don't do denial, man. I just have blinders on. I guess she was drinking when we were recording, but I didn't know it. And boy, did she drink a lot. And I was at a conference in Oklahoma. I was sitting in a golf cart with my grand sponsor, and I told Pat, I said, Pat, I think I married another alcoholic. And she got this most beautiful smile on her face, and she said, hon, sometimes I think their horns just fit the holes in our head. And you know, I need to hear that. This is the only place I've ever been where people say it's okay to love an alcoholic, and we did. My new sponsor took me up through the steps again, all of them, and I got to the eighth and ninth step. And of course, you know, who should show up on my eighth step list but my mother? You know, I had carried that guilt around 25 years, and I didn't know what to do. How do you make amends to somebody who's dead? And I was listening to a guy from the Pacific Group, Clint H. You know Clint. And I loved Clint. He was one of my heroes. But Clint was talking about going to the gravesite in Billings, Montana, and a lady named Corinne had given him paper towels and cleaner, and he went out to the gravesite and cleaned up the grave. And I heard Clint tell that story, and I thought that's a good idea. So I went and talked to my sponsor, and I wrote a letter, flew out to New Mexico, and I went down to the gravesite. Now, part of me thought this was a good idea, but there was a big part of me that thought, yeah, right, this is, go to a gravesite and read a letter. Yeah, this is going to work, really. I had contempt prior to investigation. But I went down to the gravesite, and I sat with my mom, and I read this letter, and I cried, and I read, and I just sat, and I cried, and I must have been there for a couple of hours. Finally, I left, and I came out of the cemetery, and the first person I ran into was my mother's dearest friend. And Becky said, Palmer, what were you doing today? I said, Becky, I'm just hanging out. She said, no, Palmer, really, what were you doing today? I said, really, Becky, I was hanging out. And she said again, Palmer, really, what were you doing? I mean, her question was bizarre. She was drilling, and she would not let me off the hook. And I finally said, well, Becky, I need to make amends to my mom. I left her dying of cancer, and I abandoned her. And I also broke her heart. You know, I just broke her heart. She was so afraid that I was going to die hitchhiking around the country, doing all the stuff I was doing. And Becky started laughing. You know, it's not the reaction I expected. She said, Palmer, I was with your mother the day that you left. And she was absolutely overjoyed that you were leaving because she didn't want you to see her dying of cancer. You know, it's just like that. That guilt I'd carried for 25 years was gone. I don't know how that happens. You know, I cannot organize that on my own. It's not going to happen if I'm in the driver's seat. And I literally, that guilt was removed. And I became aware at that moment the promises in my life. That we realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Absolutely. You know, today I absolutely know that there is a God. I went back, and you know, my wife was drinking. She couldn't stop. And one time I came home from work, and my dog, a little schnauzer, got me and made me go upstairs. Now, schnauzer's not very big, but they're really, you know, they don't know that. And she was just driving me up the stairs. I finally gave in and went upstairs. And she was snorting and sniffing under the door and barking and whining at me and then snorting under the door. I'm slow. I finally got the idea, and I broke the bathroom door down. And my wife was there. You know, she was out on the floor dying, and, you know, in lipstick she had written a note to, you know, goodbye and all that. I mean, it was dramatic and everything. So I called the 911, and they put her on a breathing machine. And I didn't know if she was going to live or die. I didn't know what was going to happen. But I called you and my sponsor, and a bunch of the tribe came down, were with me in the emergency waiting room, ICU waiting room. And we had a meeting. And you know, I knew in that moment, again, that I was loved and I was capable of loving these people that were there with me. Again, I don't know when that was fixed. That broken part of me was fixed. And I wasn't aware of when it happened. And you know, our opening says that we can be happy whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. And I found that that's true. I could be happy. I was going to be okay no matter whether she lived or died. I would be okay. Now, sad, that's absolutely true. But I mean, I'm not heartless, but I knew that I would be okay. She was having a bad day. I was going to be okay. She did come out of it and you know, scared her sober for a year, but life happened. And there was a point where I observed that, you know, she had no defense against the first drink, and she was off and running again. You know, I've done alcoholism with me having no program, and I've done alcoholism with me having a program, and I guarantee you that when I am working my program, I am okay, whether she drinks or not. And that's my experience, is that, I mean, I love Al-Anon because when I'm busy in Al-Anon, she can have a bad day, and I don't have to have a bad day. I used to wake up in the morning and look at her, you know, it's kind of as if I would look at her and say, gee, dear, am I happy today or what? You know, because my feelings were defined by who she was that particular day. And somehow I was given an independence of where I can feel and be what I am. I'm so grateful for that. The chair of the department, and I was still in school doing a little bit of work, and I'd graduated with my bachelor's in science education, but he said, Palmer, I want you to take this test tomorrow. And I said, okay, you know, because I've been taught to say okay. And I went down and I took this test, and in about 3 weeks the results came in. It was the GRE, and I'd done quite well on it. And he said, we'd like to offer you a fellowship to go to graduate school. And you know, there's just so many things wrong with this. I mean, you know, I'm the stupid one in the family. Why would I go to graduate school? And I'm too old to go to graduate school. I was in my 30s by that time. And again, I heard Clint. And Clint said that he'd been offered a trip to law school. And he went to his sponsor and said, do you know how old I'll be in 5 years if I go to law school? And Clancy said, well, tell me, Clint, how old are you going to be in 5 years if you don't go to law school? I need things broken down to that level of simplicity. And so I accepted this fellowship, and I started going to graduate school. And, you know, one day at a time, I'd do one paper at a time. I'd go to one class at a time. I'd take one test at a time. And I remember that I got to the point where I was whining at my sponsor. I like to say it was quality whining, but nonetheless, I was whining at my sponsor and talking about, they want me to write a book to get out of here. He said, well, tell me, Palmer, have you written the first page yet? I said, well, no, but... And he said, Palmer, why don't you write the first page, and then we'll talk about the second. And so one page at a time, I wrote my dissertation. And they kicked me out of the University of Oklahoma with a PhD in chemistry. You know, I don't know how that happens. I don't know how you go from this homeless bum to somebody who has a PhD in chemistry. That doesn't happen. There's no road from here to here. It does not exist except through God, the steps, the fellowship, taking me one day at a time from there to there. I can't do this on my own. I have not the power. And yet, here I am. My wife and I moved to Florida. I got a position on the faculty at a university in Miami. I'm on the faculty, and one of the things that just amuses me is that I asked for one of my defects of character is being a caretaker. You know, now it was a defect in my life because most of the time I was trying to take care of people, who didn't want to be cared for in ways they didn't want to be cared for, and so it was a defect. And yet, in God's hands, it became one of my greatest assets. He gave me a job as a caretaker. Today, I just go to work and I take care of God's kids. And I don't know how that happened, but I'm very effective in taking care of God's kids on a daily basis as a teacher. And I just love doing what I do. You know, when it says that our task is to become of maximum service to God and those about us, you know, that's my job today, is to take care of those about me. And I don't know how that happens. I love doing it. You know, one Thanksgiving, our kids were down, and my wife and I were preparing Thanksgiving dinner, and she started drinking. And she got drunk, and she passed out, and, you know, part of the dinner got burned and everything. And I had a two sponsor call day that day. I called him, you know, I've got a resentment. You know what she did today? And of course, we worked through the resentment, and I was able to put the dinner together and put it on the table, and we ate. And she came stumbling out later and kind of ate some leftovers. And you know, it just, because that's the last thing I want to do when you're coming off a drunk is to eat biscuits, dressing and gravy. But she did. She sobered up about 3-4 months later. And we were speaking as a couple at a meeting 10-15 years ago, I don't remember. And she told this story about how one Thanksgiving she had gotten drunk and burned the turkey, and she had felt so ashamed that she had gone back to AA with a vengeance, got a sponsor and did the steps and did the deal and sobered up. That, you know, how different is our perception? This event that I had two calls to my sponsor because I resented had been the very thing I had prayed that would happen. And I didn't recognize it coming down. You know, it was exactly what I wanted. I know today from that, you know, very often God is doing for me what I don't see it. And it's, if I will just allow things to unfold, it is an amazing event. That, you know, I mean, amazing events will happen and follow, and that's absolutely true in my life. All I have to do is quit directing. I don't have the resume to be God. I just let God do the direction, and things come out wonderfully. My wife and I, she has 18 years of sobriety now, yeah. And that's a miracle, you know, but that's her miracle. My miracle is just that I've got this time in Al-Anon, and we have a home that I absolutely love today. You know, sometimes, you know, she's talking to one of her sponsees in the back of the house, and I'm at the other end of the house talking to one of my guys, or, you know, we've got meetings that I've got guys in doing a big book study, or she's, you know, it's just, we have a program home today, and I absolutely love that. No, we can't. You know, if we snap at each other, it's not very long before I'm sorry, you know. And we make amends to each other and try to keep things good. You know, it's just our life is amazing. You know, she's at a different conference this weekend. She wanted to be here and can't because of Chapters to Recovery in Miami. And she's with her sponsor. And you know, I don't know how that happens. About 12 years ago, we got a call from my son, and he invited us to come over to Tampa to be part of the birth of my granddaughter. So my wife and I, this wife, the incumbent, she likes for me to say I had two, because she wants you to know she never had a gun. She doesn't do any of that. You know, doesn't have knives. But my wife and I went over, and my first wife was there. And you know, we were able to be in the room and bless the arrival of my granddaughter with my son and his wife. And you know, I don't know how that happens. I don't have the power, certainly, to put a family back together. And yet, while I've been doing this stuff and turning into whatever it is that God's turning me into, the family was put back together. Those resentments were gone. When I made amends to my first wife for my part of the relationship going south, I was freed of that resentment just immediately. It was gone. I was free of the terror that was in my life because of what she might or might not do. It was just all gone, and life was different. I don't know what happened to her. I just don't know. But I know that the steps worked for me. My grand sponsor's husband, Jack, used to say that the 12 steps, when well worked, inevitably lead to a relationship with God. And I came from this point where it was like, you know, no, I don't do God, to where today I absolutely know that God is there and working in my life. And there, I mean, how can we stand here and look out among you, a bunch of people who are supposed to be dead, and yet you're sitting here pretending to listen to an Al-Anon speaker? You know, it's how could we not know that there is a God? The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, you know, I was at this meeting one time, and everybody was talking about their white light experience, and you know, I went home and I called my sponsor and I told him, I said, you know, I don't get it. You know, all these people having white light experiences, when am I going to get my spiritual awakening? And, you know, that's one of those things that you just can't unsay, and you can't reel it back in. And he was just laughing, just belly laughing at me. Finally said, Palmer, I want you to think back a minute to what you were like 2 weeks before you came to Al-Anon. And so I thought back, and I was remembering what I was like when I came in the doors. And it was, you know, that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and that place of, you know, just utter despair. And he said, now I want you to think about what you're like today. And I could see the most amazing transformation. It reminded me of the story that I've heard. Now, if you remember PETA, I've not tried this, but I'm told that if you throw a frog in boiling water, they'll jump out. But if you take them and put them in cold water and slowly, incrementally turn up the heat, that they'll stay and boil to death. And I think that's how we get out into the disease of one little increment at a time. But I know that's also how we get to that spiritual awakening, if we have the educational variety. One little bit at a time, and it's so slow and subtle that I didn't see it until I saw it. That, oh my God, I've come from there to here. Absolutely, I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I was at a funeral for the father of a very dear friend of mine many years ago, and the minister was talking about grace. And I realized I have no clue what grace is. I don't know. So I went to Webster's Dictionary. I know it's non-conference-approved literature, but it says that grace is unmerited divine assistance given man for his sanctification or regeneration. I have done absolutely nothing to earn my place in Al-Anon. I don't deserve it. I don't earn it. It's just a gift that God offers all of us. All I had to do was pick up the pen and paper. I just had to do what was asked of me to do. It's kind of like if we go to the beach or out in a field and open our hands, the sunlight shines on our hands. It's there for everybody and it doesn't run out. But if I go out with my fists closed like this, I don't get any warmth on my palms. The only thing that I did was I opened my palms and I did what you suggested that I do. I understand regeneration. You know, I've been made anew. I'm not that Charlie Manson-y kind of guy standing in front of you today. I've been reborn, absolutely, because I'm not that guy. I didn't know what sanctification meant, so I went back to the S's, and it says to be set free. That's what you've done for me. I didn't do anything to earn it. You have made me anew, and you've set me free. Thank you for my life.
We'll close with the Lord's Prayer.